Alt NPR.
Yeah, this is a good place to get this tattoo.
Oh, it's the easiest place to get tattoos on your arm.
Yeah, I've actually wanted to get this tattoo for a long time.
Oh, cool.
Spray can with the word Ubik on it and the spray coming out facing my heart. Ubik is the name of one of my favorite Philip K. Dick books. Have you ever read any Philip K. Dick?
Nope.
Most of the books are pretty hard to explain, and Ubik's definitely not an exception, but it's basically about this guy, Joe Chip, whose world starts disintegrating and falling apart. Oh, Joe is a tester for an anti-psionic league, which is, in the future, you know, you have all the precogs and the psychics messing with normal people's lives, so, you know, there's agencies out there to combat them. And Joe works for that one of those agencies. And what happens is the team, they're on this big assignment, and an explosion goes off, and they're ambushed. And the boss, Glenn Runciter, ends up getting killed. So they throw the boss, Glenn Runciter, in cold pack. In this future, it's discovered that when you die, you're not really dead. You still have some life left in your brain if you're put into storage, and you know your relatives and friends can come talk to you through a little microphone device to your suspended animation. So they get the boss into this cold storage and they try to see if there's a signal, and Joe and his colleagues start noticing that the world's disintegrating around them. Like, they'd buy some cigarettes and they'd crumble in their hands, they'd get some cream for the coffee and it would be sour, and all of a sudden, the phone book is like 3 years out of date, and the money starts going out of date. So obviously, something is going on, and they finally figure it out in the bathroom when they see some writing on the lavatory wall that says, "Jump in the urinal and stand on your head. I'm the one who's alive. You are all dead." And it's a message from their boss, who, you know, the guy they put in the cold storage. Because basically it turns out that they're the ones that are all dead in cold storage, and their boss is on the outside world trying to talk to them. And it's very distressing for them to learn this from graffiti in the bathroom, but that's the only place the boss was able to get in touch with them. And I love that phrase, too. "I'm the one who's alive, you're all dead." I tried to spray paint that myself on a bathroom in Germany once, but I got caught and yelled at in German. It's very distressing. There's kind of two forces going on here. You have the force of decay and entropy, everything falling apart, and then you have the force of good, which is Glenn Runciter trying to fix things, and he tells Joe Chip, our hero, that the only way he's going to be able to fight the forces of decay and destruction is to get a can of Ubik. And Ubik is some substance that exists in a spray can that if you spray it on things, everything will go back to normal. A little spray of Ubik will fix everything. And for me, this always resonated with me because, well, you know, who wouldn't want a spray can to fix things that are falling apart in your life?
Well, now you always got it.
Taken as directed, Ubik provides uninterrupted sleep without morning after grogginess. You awaken fresh, ready to tackle all those little annoying problems facing you. Do not exceed recommended dosage.
There are over 50 books by Philip K. Dick on my bookshelf, but the one I always find myself reaching for whenever I'm in need of something to keep myself from slashing my wrist, stuffing my gullet with pills, or laying down on the garage floor with the car turned on Interesting fact, Philip K. Dick once tried doing all three of these things simultaneously. But anyway, whenever I find my universe falling apart, I reach for Ubik.
Perk up pouting household surfaces with new Miracle Ubik, the easy-to-apply, extra-shiny, non-stick plastic coating. Entirely harmless if used as directed. Saves endless scrubbing, glides you right out of the kitchen.
My name is Benjamin Walker, and this is The Theory of Everything. This week, we're making a case for Philip K. Dick. Today, it's no longer necessary to argue that Philip K. Dick deserves mainstream recognition. He's already got it. He's taught in major universities, name-dropped in all the important book reviews, and most of his stories and novels are optioned by the big Hollywood studios. Thanks to his dedicated followers, Philip K. Dick is and will always be a major writer, a canonical figure of American literature. The case that we're pushing on the radio program this week is for the canonization of Philip K. Dick, the saint. For Ubik is just one of many literary inventions that Philip K. Dick has left for us to aid us in the never-ending battle against death, decay, and destruction. Ubik is but one of his many guidebooks that teach us how to live in a universe that is now, more than ever, falling apart.
I am Ubik. Before the universe was, I am. I made the suns. I made the worlds. They go as I say, they do as I tell them. I am called Ubik, but that is not my name. I am, I shall always be.
A few days after I got my Ubik tattoo, I was struck by the idea that I certainly couldn't have been the only one so inspired. So I googled Ubik tattoo and Dick. Up popped the writer, Jonathan Lethem. Obviously it was a sign, for Jonathan Lethem, author of the best-selling novels Motherless Brooklyn and Fortress of Solitude, spent the good part of the 1980s as, in his words, a lieutenant in the cult of Philip K. Dick. So I decided to telephone him up. Now, in most cases, a telephone call from someone claiming to have the same tattoo as you should probably be ignored. But, well, Jonathan Lethem understood where I was coming from. In fact, he knows firsthand how, in the world of Philip K. Dick, the desire for contact is not something to be taken lightly.
When I was in college, my first began college in 1982, I had this fantasy that I would drop out and run away to California, where I'd never been, and meet Philip K. Dick and sort of present myself to him, because I felt that I was I had to make contact with this guru. I was kind of like, you know, in Flaky Foont in the Mr. Natural comic books that R. Crumb drew. I thought I had to go to the feet of the master. But I didn't get my chance. Dick died in 1982, which was just when I was 18 and just beginning to think I could, you know, make this pilgrimage. So a couple of years later, I went to California anyway, and I managed to make contact with Paul Williams, who was running the Philip K. Dick estate and something called the Philip K. Dick Society. And I just thought this was the next best thing. So I made myself into the official, you know, envelope liquor, stamp liquor, editorial gopher for the Philip K. Dick Society, and did everything I could to involve myself in this what was at that point a very grassroots attempt to revive his literary career, or in a way to create his literary career for the first time, because he was, even when he was publishing and many of his books were in print, they were in a form that was regarded as so marginal, so subliterary, he might as well have not published. He was so marginal. Because of course, for those who cared about him, he was already a great writer, and I felt that way. I didn't know that much about the quote-unquote literary mainstream at that point. I didn't care that much about it. I thought anyone who picked up one of his books would recognize that he was a great writer, and since I knew a lot of people who'd done that, that he probably, you know, I sort of mistook myself and a small band of other people for a consensus.
So back in the day, before Philip K. Dick became famous, there was
you know, legions of underground fans who would sometimes refer to themselves as dickheads. It was quite a spirited movement, and I'm wondering if you could share with us a glimpse of what this cult was like.
Well, legions is probably an exaggeration. If there'd been legions, it wouldn't have been, you know, kind of a mimeographed newsletter sort of subculture. There were really just hundreds of people who felt so struck by their encounter with this guy's writing that in that murky period, just before and just after his death, when so much of his work, almost all of it, was out of print, these few of us began sort of clamoring for more attention and, you know, wanting to get books back in print. And I mean, that's really what it was a kind of indigenous literary tribal organization. There's an element there's a messianistic impulse that Dick writes about. Dick experienced himself very vividly for better and worse in his own life experience, and which he inspires very readily in readers. And so there was a feeling of having a message that we wanted to bear into the world. You know, here's this group of books, here's this career, here's this strange writer. But it was also, in a way, here's this language for describing what's so absurd and infuriating about contemporary reality. And it's a better language. It's a more telling one. And, you know, it will create this feeling of recognition or enlightenment in readers if they encounter it. And so it does have a little bit of a tang of a kind of missionary work. And we certainly had a missionary zeal. But I think there's something really fascinating about writing or art in general that creates intrinsically a feeling of private communion in the reader, or in the audience member, where what you feel is, well, only I understand this guy. He's writing just for me. You know, even if other people may know about him, I'm having a more personal encounter. I'm receiving a secret decoder message for my, you know, for my secret decoder ring. And Dick does provide this, no matter how many people become you know, members of the cult. It still is a cult in a funny way. I mean, I think that there are comparisons for that in other realms. I always think that Devo, the rock band Devo, was a great example of this, that even when they, you know, would have number one or top 10 hits like Whip It, they still, the message that they sent out, the language that they used, the iconography of their band and its critique of everyday reality, meant that everybody who liked Devo felt that only they really understood, and that everyone else wasn't quite getting it.
Well, I think when we talk about Philip K. Dick and people not quite getting it, it's movies like The Matrix or the Truman Show, where they're taking this sense that, you know, reality might not be what it seems, and then if you peel it back, you'll discover the real reality. That seems to me, you know, not getting it.
But that's a classic instance of someone's greatest, you know, insight being boiled down for a kind of commercially palatable presentation. I mean, you're exactly right. Those things feel very much like they're indebted to Philip K. Dick, if not, you know, overly indebted to Philip K. Dick, to the point where you feel that he's been grave robbed a little bit. But they also feel absolutely inadequate or absolutely paltry beside his actual work. You know, if Philip K. Dick had written The Matrix or The Truman Show, those would have been basically like the first chapter of one of his novels. What Dick discovered, I almost said understood, but I'm not even sure he understood it, because it was really more an intuitive or emotional discovery, was that the search is never finished. And he'd take an idea, what we now, I think, could safely say is a kind of Dickian idea, like the ones that are the premises for those two films you mentioned, and he would start out writing that idea, but the restless part of him would be unsatisfied with the obvious answer that, you know, behind the Truman Show lies, you know, the manipulative corporation, and he would turn it another degree, and then another degree, and he'd keep peeling away the levels, so that you would end up, instead of in a kind of pat mystery story where there's a series of, you know, esoteric clues that give way to a satisfying finale where, you know, let's say, you know, Tom Cruise gets to, you know, confront Max von Sydow and bring the corporation tumbling down, you'd discover that Max von Sydow had his own existential problems and that there were an endless series of reality breakdowns yet to be discovered, and that the nature of reality was a kind of a cascading sequence of unveilings and then remaskings.
I get the sense that Jonathan Lethem is not as incensed by the Hollywoodization of Dick as I am, but he certainly feels that when Philip K. Dick is pigeonholed as some sci-fi writer who was merely ahead of his time, the true genius of what Dick has to offer us is more often than not totally missed.
You know, Dick was not really a predictive writer. He ends up seeming so incredibly ahead of his time, and certainly we are living in his world right now, seemingly much more than when he wrote the book, so it can make him seem like a kind of visionary. But I think the truth is that what he did was begin to name with his images and metaphors and concepts, with the paradoxes that he described, he began to create a language, a series of labels and names for experiences that, you know, contemporary reality has made so universal, but which were so hard to describe before, you know, he came along. And in a lot of cases, he was just taking the 1950s or the 1960s and the texture of the world he saw around him and just exaggerating it slightly, making it ridiculous. But in doing so, he ended up describing its, you know, the absurdist truth lying underneath the skin of it. So the funnier he tried to be, the more truthful he was. What I love about Dick and what makes him so personal for me isn't that he represents existence as a series of kind of paranoid existential crises. It's that he does that and then takes that as a backdrop. And what he builds on top of the assumption that life is a series of paranoid existential crises or ontological crises is the sense that human contact and human intimacy and human meaning and creativity, small moments, artwork, a song, a poem, are themselves so valuable against the great universal emptiness, against this great sense of you know, unresolvable menace that lurks behind human existence, and are therefore to be treasured and pursued and, you know, cherished and handed from one character to the next as tokens. And, you know, this is a very consoling vision, a very humble one, very homely and yearning one. When I find myself facing the void, I don't curse Dick for reminding me that this is what it's all about. I'm grateful for him for reminding me of the way to tiptoe away from the void, or to turn my back on it and pay attention to what matters instead.
Approximately September 17th, 1977. I'm Philip K. Dick. This is my speech. The title of it is, If You Find This World Bad, You Should See Some of the Others.
In Philip K. Dick's novel Ubik, the dead are never really dead. Whenever one finds oneself missing the dearly departed, one simply hops on over to the moratorium and plugs in the speakerphone. So let's plug in and listen to the voice of Philip K. Dick, as he is also sorely missed. This is a recording he made in 1977. It's a tape he made of himself practicing a speech that he was going to give at a conference of admirers in France.
May I tell you how much I appreciate your asking me to share some of my ideas with you? A novelist carries with him constantly what most women carry in large purses, much that is useless, a few absolutely essential items, and then, for good measure, a great number of things which fall in between. But the novelist does not transport them physically, because his trove of possessions is mental. Now and then he adds a new and entirely useless idea. Now and then he reluctantly cleans out the trash, the obviously worthless ideas, and with a few sentimental tears sheds them. Once in a great while, however, he happens by chance onto a thoroughly stunning idea, new to him, which he hopes will turn out to be new to everyone else. It is this final category which dignifies his existence. An odd aspect of these rare, extraordinarily valuable ideas, which puzzles me, is their mystifying cloak of, shall I say, the obvious. By that I mean, once the idea has emerged or appeared or been born, however it is that new ideas pass over into being, the novelist says to himself, but of course, why didn't I realize that years ago? But note the word realize. It is the key word. He has come across something new, which at the same time was there somewhere all the time. In truth, it simply surfaced. It always was. He did not invent it or even find it. In a very real sense, it found him. And this is a little frightening to contemplate, he has not invented it, but on the contrary, it invented him. It is as if the idea created him for its purposes. I think this is why we discover a startling phenomenon of great renown, that quite often in history, a great new idea strikes a number of researchers or thinkers at exactly the same time, all of them oblivious to their compeers. Its time has come, we say about the idea, and so dismiss, as if we had explained it, something I consider quite important, our recognition that in a certain literal sense, ideas are alive.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it's no longer necessary to write about why the world should pay attention to Philip K. Dick. It's already been done, and the mission has already been accomplished. Some of these pieces, however, like Paul Williams' 1974 article for Rolling Stone and Steve Erickson's 1990 piece for the LA Weekly, are wonderful aids in understanding the importance and significance of this literary visionary. My personal favorite piece of Dick scholarship was written by Josh Glenn, the editor of the now defunct magazine, The Hermonaut. In his essay, Josh lays out how Philip K. Dick can help us not only make sense of our world, but cope with it as well. I gave Josh Glenn a call to see what he thought of my idea of St. Phil.
Well, of course, any writer who grows a big full beard during their own lifetime is going to be revered as a prophet at some later date. You just look at, you know, Jack Kerouac versus Allen Ginsberg. Everyone likes Jack Kerouac, but Ginsberg is some kind of holy, you know, saint, prophet-type figure. Or like George Harrison, the Beatle, kept his beard the longest, you know what I mean? Today, like when he died, people were just, you know, he was some kind of holy guru figure. People might have thought John Lennon was cooler, but George Harrison was some kind of saint.
Because of the beard.
Because of the beard, yeah. This is a theory that's leaping to mind, but... Dick, you know, that when his books got all re-released starting in, I guess, the 80s, That's what they would always show, right? Him with the beard or whatever.
Philip K. Dick famously defined reality as that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. But this is by no means Dick's only definition of reality. There are many. Josh Glenn likes this one. Reality is not so much what you perceive, but rather what you make of it. This, he says, contains the kernel of Dick's wisdom, that it's possible to live authentically in a fake world.
When the world shatters around you into fragments, fragments that cannot be put back together, do you just sort of wallow in that misery? I mean, some people, it's almost, you know, they enjoy that experience of how horrible that is, and they can wallow in it and be happy. Or do you try to heroically put it all back together? But he says no, it's not going to be possible. But the only thing that is possible and that is hopeful and that will give you, you know, something resembling the only thing that's possible after meaning becomes impossible, whatever version of meaning is still possible, is the endless shuffling through the fragments and the creative act of interpretation, and you know, placing these fragments of reality in juxtaposition to each other. That is your creative act. That's how you're participating in reality. It's a judo act, right? It's if you become convinced that everything's artificial and that yourself is an illusion, you know, and that you have just over time sort of been instructed and socialized into cobbling together some kind of persona that is real, and you suddenly realize that it's not real. That's an awful feeling. And if you actually believe that the world around you, things that couldn't seem more real, are themselves, for one reason or another, an illusion, again, it's, you feel insane. It's crazy. But there is a way, in Dick, there is a way to find not only just sort of a base level survival, but also a real affirmative way of being in that world in a sort of, you know, I hate to keep using the word authentic, but, you know, the best possible way of living, yeah, is precisely this, is to sort of embrace the artificiality of it, of everything, including yourself and truth. You know, once you have embraced that, and to say, okay, well, actually, the only thing that is true is this, is the truth that I, you know, invent.
Philip K. Dick was obsessed with two questions: what is real and what is human? For Dick, the world seemed less than real because more often than not, the people living in it seemed less than human. For Josh Glenn, if we follow Dick's lead and seek out what is authentically human, we might find what is authentically real as well.
In a science fiction world, you know, you can have androids who look just like people and talk just like people and can think for themselves and make decisions. So in what sense are they not a human? And he finally decided the answer was love and empathy. In his world, in his science fiction universe, androids, the one thing that they can't do is feel empathy for another, because they're androids. That's the human quality that they lack. And he felt this was, that empathy and love was being drummed out of people, of Americans in the mid-century. He would say people are becoming androidized. People are being pacified and put on tranquilizers and everything from public education to television programming to the drugs that were prescribed by psychoanalysis was just getting everyone to fit in and conform and become more like each other and just be automatons. So reality for him, I think he uses at one point, was where he connects the nature of reality and the nature of what it means to be human. He says reality is love. So in his books, even if he can't exactly say what the truth is, his characters can let themselves be drawn towards warmth and human emotion and love, and they can kind of go in their gut instinct. You know, if faced with 10 different choices of what's real, if one of the choices, which looks just as fake as all the other ones, somehow makes them sense that there's some love there, some emotion there, some empathy there, then they know they can't be wrong in going in that direction.
That's it for this week's Theory of Everything. Thanks to Sam Wolf, Josh Glenn, and Jonathan Lethem. You can find Josh Glenn every week in the Ideas section of the Sunday Boston Globe. Jonathan Lethem's new book is a collection of short stories called Men and Cartoons, and his latest novel, Fortress of Solitude, is now available in paperback. Sam Wolf tattoos at Chameleon Tattoos and Body Piercing in Harvard Square. Make sure you visit us at toeradio.org, where you can read essays on Philip K. Dick by both of my guests and listen to and download not only this week's broadcast, but outtakes as well. This radio program was produced for WZBC in Newton by myself and is distributed through the Public Radio Exchange at prx.org. I'm Benjamin Walker. Tune in next week for another Theory of Everything.
Alt.